We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome Maren McKenna. She is a senior fellow at the Schuster Institute in Brandeis University, a journalist who covers public policy issues, and of course, author of Big Chicken, the incredible story of how antibiotics created modern agriculture, changed the way the world eats. Welcome to the program, Maren.
Thank you for having me.
So, well, give us a sense of what chicken was like in the pre-antibiotic days. I mean, it wasn't even really a staple of at least Americans' diets.
That's true. I mean, of course, none of us were around, but I think our grandparents or great-grandparents would have testified that they had chickens out the back door or on the small family farm all the time. But those chickens were there mostly to produce eggs, and were mostly eaten after they were done with their egg production. So they were older, and they were scrawnier, and they were something that you ate only once in a while. But then chicken got transformed. The chickens that we eat today look nothing like and taste nothing like those chickens of our grandparents' time, and they were transformed by intensive breeding and by precision nutrition and by our desire to eat protein a lot more often, and I think more than anything because of routine use of antibiotics.
All right. Well, before we get to the antibiotics, like, what was it that was there a specific jump in demand? Was there some type of push because someone saw some profit here? What was it? What was it that I guess was the catalyst for that change?
I think you put your finger on it when you said profit. There's a really interesting history in chicken in which time and time again, various kinds of innovation sort of cluster around poultry production, and the supply of chicken actually gets out in front of the demand for chicken. And so periodically there are these transformations in which the poultry industry has to convince people to eat more chicken. And they did it in a number of ways, but the main way they did it, aside from antibiotic use, was by transforming the way chickens look, so that those chickens of our grandparents' time would have been sort of upright, and they would have exercised, they would have run around the barnyard and flapped up into trees, and they would have been kind of slender, and they would have had colored feathers. And now the chickens we eat today are rotund and placid and white feathered, and they have very big breasts, and they're very sort of tippy when they stand up, and they're just nothing like chickens as chickens evolved to be.
And what was the primary source of protein in American diets when chicken it sort of came onto the scene as a primary source of protein?
So people really used to eat much more beef. And you can pinpoint when chicken starts to become, as it is now, the meat that we eat more than any other with a lot of precision. It dates back to 1977, to the first government guidelines on what Americans should eat, what we now call the Dietary Guidelines for Americans. In 1977, the government says Americans should eat less saturated fat, and that is almost universally interpreted as we should eat less red meat and we should eat more white meat, essentially. And from that year, you can see the demand curve take off. That's the first year in which people eat more chicken than they do beef, and it goes up and up and up every year as beef goes down and down.
That's fascinating. Is that and obviously we're going to go back in time to where antibiotics comes into this, but it was in the early 70s. I think it was like around 72. It was under the Nixon administration where we changed our policy about corn, and we started subsidizing corn significantly, which drove I know like beef production. Did it also impact chicken production?
So chickens are, you know, those chickens of the barnyard, the chickens of our grandparents and great-grandparents' time, they would have been feeding themselves for the most part, running around outside, scratching up bugs and insects and so forth. And then we brought them inside and we started feeding them grains. And corn is one of the chief components of chicken feed. So the more you make corn affordable and easily accessible. And the more you expand the production of corn, the more you can expand inexpensively the production of the proteins that are fed on corn.
All right. So let's go back to the introduction of antibiotics and into chicken, and then I guess ultimately into livestock from there. I mean, where was it first introduced?
It's a really fascinating story, and I feel like it was kind of lost to history. It certainly wasn't something I knew all the details of. And to understand how this happened, how we got to the point where antibiotics are routinely added to the diets of livestock all over the world, not just chickens, but pigs and cattle as well, you have to go back to the end of World War II, where two things happen at once. The first is that antibiotics come on the scene for use in human medicine. Penicillin only arrives on the battlefields of World War II in about 1943, and then there are other antibiotics that follow along soon after that. And the second is that at the end of the war, the entire system of food production feels really fragile and uncertain because of the war's damage and because of the necessity to cut costs after the guaranteed market of all those soldiers and sailors needing to be fed goes away. And so the antibiotic manufacturers start looking for other uses for their new drugs at the same time that the food production system starts looking for cheap supplements to make the cheap feed they're starting to use more nutritious. And into that collision of those two trends walks one scientist, a man named Thomas Jukes, who decides to try one of the new antibiotics as a feed supplement for chickens. And the chickens get fat faster than they would have otherwise. And from that one experiment at the end of 1948 emerges an industry that you know, within 5 years of his first trial, American farmers are giving their livestock, starting with chicken, 500,000 pounds of antibiotics a year. And now in the United States, in the most recent federal data, it's 34 million pounds.
Wow. Now, I mean, the thing that you write that I think people don't understand is, I mean, I think we all perceive antibiotics as being something that is produced for people, and that animals get it as an ancillary to the production of antibiotics for people, but it's sort of flipped, isn't it?
That's exactly right. And that was the thing that really made me want to investigate this use of antibiotics in animals, is that I came at this as someone writing about public health, aware of antibiotic resistance as a profound health threat to people, and hearing public health authorities like the director of the CDC saying we have to conserve antibiotics, we have to protect their action, use them very carefully. And then I turned around, and in agriculture, vast amounts, tons and tons of antibiotics were being given to animals that were not sick, were being given for reasons other than to cure infections. And that was so counter to what I was hearing from the medical side that I had to figure out what was going on.
How do antibiotics make a chicken? I mean, how does antibiotics make a chicken fatter?
How does it work? Right. So there's two ways that we use antibiotics in animals, and three ways really, and some of them are easier to understand than others. So first, in a few animals, we use them actually to cure infections, and that's just the way we use them in humans. Then we use them sort of prophylactically to prevent animals getting sick. And then there's this growth promotion, this thing that dates back to 1948. Those antibiotics are given in feed and water, and they go into the animal's guts. They affect the mix of bacteria that live in the guts of animals and in every living thing, including us, in such a way that they change how the animals take nutrients out of their diet. And they speed up their metabolism, speed up the ways in which they put on the tasty muscle that we want to eat. But at the same time, they're also encouraging the emergence and the growth of antibiotic-resistant bacteria in those guts. And that's where the problem, the larger threat to human health, emerges from this routine antibiotic use.
Now, Jukes, you write, never ever really came to accept that there was anything but good coming from pouring these antibiotics into chickens. Is that right?
It's as far as I can tell, to the end of his life. He died in the 90s. He ferociously defended this as a way to feed the world inexpensively. And Jukes is a really interesting guy because throughout the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, he was what we'd think of as a very modern science communicator. He didn't just do science that was published in scientific journals. He wrote op-eds all over the place, including in the New York Times, and relentlessly defended this use of antibiotics as the thing that was going to feed the world.
What was his relationship with antibiotic manufacturers? Just out of curiosity.
Well, he worked for one. The reason why he was able to do that first experiment in 1948 was that he was on the staff of one of the first companies making antibiotics, which was a company that at the time was called Letterly Laboratories. It was just outside New York City, and it belonged to a larger company that had emerged from after World War II called American Cyanamid. So he took his own company's drug, the leftovers from making his company's drug, which was called chlortetracycline or oreomycin, and that's what he fed to the chickens in that experiment. And it's really fascinating in some of the paperwork that goes back to the 40s, he records that some of the other scientists in his company asked him not to do this and asked the company not to start selling antibiotics in the way that they were, which pretty quickly was by the tank car load. And he and his boss went ahead because they said competition was right on our heels.
Why did those? I mean, this is actually I was getting to this, and I think I might be a little bit jaded for the amount of time that I spend with tort lawyers. But what and product liability lawyers? What did those other scientists say at that time?
They were veterinarians, and they said this is going to create antibiotic resistance in the animals that you're going to be feeding the antibiotics to, and the results of that are unpredictable. And they had good reason to believe that, because just a few years earlier, Alexander Fleming, the scientist who found penicillin, warned in 1945, when he was accepting the Nobel Prize, that if we did not conserve antibiotics and use them very carefully, antibiotic resistance would result. Now, he was talking about misusing them
in humans,
but the way he describes what might happen, he talks about someone going to the pharmacy and buying penicillin and dosing himself and underdosing himself. He was describing, without knowing it, exactly what was going to happen in agriculture, where animals would receive these tiny doses, too small to cure an infection, that would nevertheless exert an effect on the bacteria in their systems and cause resistance to emerge.
Let's talk about Reimart, is it Ravenholt in Seattle? Because
this is
where we get a notion of this, and also discuss. I don't have it in front of me. That process.
Acronizing. So
yes.
So this is once a process starts to become profitable, you sort of know how it's going to go, right? So the company that started this whole business of growth promotion, Letterly Laboratories, for which Thomas Jukes worked, which made the drug chlortetracycline or oreomycin, they apparently got the idea that if they were selling their drug all over the country for use in living animals, and they got the idea, what if we were able to sell one more dose after the animals were dead? And they patented a process and sold it to slaughterhouses all over the country by which chicken and later fish that had been butchered and disassembled was dipped in a solution of antibiotics and then packaged for sale. And the idea was that this antibiotic staying on the meat, on the raw meat, would delay the growth of the bacteria that caused spoilage, so that a package of raw meat could sit in a grocery cold case for weeks instead of for days. And as with so many things in this story, they had good intentions. They wanted to save food from being wasted, but there were unintended consequences. And Reimart Ravenholt, the gentleman you mentioned, this physician who still is alive in his 90s in Seattle in the mid-1950s as one of the first disease detectives at the Centers for Disease Control, noticed that there was an outbreak spreading among slaughterhouse workers in Seattle of really gruesome skin infections on their arms and hands. And it turned out that they were handling chickens that had already been fed antibiotics in this process in the slaughterhouse in which they were being dipped in more antibiotics. these men had superbug infections, and the superbugs had emerged from the bacteria in the chickens being exposed to antibiotics and then not killed by that antibiotic bath because they were already resistant.
Oh, God. And so it wasn't necessarily a problem with the bath. It was just that in the course of handling it that much, it exposed what was going on in terms of the resistance.
Well, in that particular case, in that outbreak that Ravenholt investigated, the problem was that the bath exposed what was going on, that these superbugs were existing and getting ramped up. But the antibiotic bath itself, that was a problem because it was another way of putting an untrammeled, uncontrolled amount of antibiotics out into the world.
And so when did that, please tell me that practice has ended.
It's over, that's right, yeah. It lasted until the late 1960s, and then what happens is it's not so much that anyone says specifically acronizing, as they called it, has got to go. It's more that in the late 1960s, society as a whole starts to become suspicious of food additives of all kinds, like artificial sweeteners and hormones in cattle. There's a whole sort of the beginnings of a citizen movement around that. And as part of that, people start questioning what's going on in their chicken. And it's fascinating. I went back into a lot of old newspapers and read letters to the editor and grocery store ads and so forth. And the grocery store ads for several years boasted in their fine print, "We have acronized chicken." And then there's a certain point where it turns to, "Our chicken is not acronized," because people are writing into their local papers saying, "Well, we don't know what's going on in our chicken, and that doesn't make us very comfortable, and we think the chicken producer should stop."
Interesting. And who was, like, I mean, where, what were the entity? Was it just magazine writers are writing about this? Was there, you write about Will Harris. Were there other, tell us about Will Harris, if there's others.
Oh, Will Harris is one of my modern day heroes. There have always been people who've held themselves apart from the whole process of using antibiotics in the raising of livestock, which is a thing that continues up to the present day, though in the United States it has started to change. It started to change in January this year thanks to regulations that were put in by the Obama administration just before they left. But Will Harris, a great man, is the proprietor of a fourth, now fifth generation family farm in southwest Georgia. His father grew their family farm up into a big cow-calf operation using hormones and antibiotics and pesticides and herbicides. And Will, in his 40s, after he'd taken over the farm, decided that was not the way to go. And now he runs a property that is fully antibiotic-free, fully organic, has 10 species on it, has beautiful green rolling pastures, has its own USDA-approved slaughterhouses, and it's profitable, and it shows that there's another way to take meat production that doesn't involve routine antibiotic use.
Well, let's talk about the public policy changes, because it seems like the Obama administration was able to do something that hadn't been done for 30, there was attempts to do for 30, maybe 40 years? Is that right?
That's right. In the Carter administration, when Jimmy Carter brought his young crew of reformers into the White House in 1976, one of the things they had their eyes on was what was going on at the FDA, and the FDA had given the approvals for using antibiotics routinely in agriculture. And so Carter's new FDA commissioner, a doctor named Donald Kennedy, a PhD named Donald Kennedy, proposed that he was going to take away the licenses that the FDA had granted in the 50s for using antibiotics in this manner. And he told the drug manufacturers that he was going to hold a set of hearings, and they would have to show up and prove that their drugs were safe. And if they couldn't, he was going to yank the licenses. And he never got to hold that hearing because a powerful congressman from Mississippi who had oversight over the FDA's budget told the White House that if Kennedy went ahead moving against antibiotics, this congressman, Jamie Whitten, would hold the FDA's entire budget hostage. And so the Carter White House forced Kennedy to back off, and he only stayed in government service maybe another 2 years, and then he later on became the president of Stanford University. And thus a stalemate was created between the FDA and veterinary pharma and the large animal production groups that lasted, as you say, more than 30 years, until in 2013, the Obama administration announced that they were going to try again. And, you know, a number of things had happened. That very long-serving congressman had finally retired. Public policy was changing. Consumers were thinking differently about the use of antibiotics in the meat they buy. And so the Obama administration was successful, and they put in regulations. Technically, they're called guidances. They're not regulations with the force of law, that on January 1st of this year, growth promoter antibiotics are no longer used in the United States. And if producers use any other antibiotics in any other form, they're supposed to be supervised by a veterinarian, which didn't used to be the case. It used to be they could just walk down to a farm supply store and buy a bag of antibiotics and use it with no oversight. And now they can't do that anymore.
So in that the interim, we should say that the practice of using antibiotics this way migrated from chickens into beef, I guess.
Into most meat animals. In fact, went from chickens kind of taught the rest of animal agriculture how to misuse antibiotics. Fairly quickly, it was picked up by pigs at the Hormel Institute, run by the people who brought you Spam. And then that same practice moved into cattle. So there actually are some fairly significant poultry companies now turning against antibiotic use on their own. Actually, they started in advance of the Obama administration rules. So it's kind of interesting to me that the chicken which taught agriculture how to misuse antibiotics might provide the model to help agriculture move away from that historic mistake.
Does antibiotics, it seems to me, clearly provided the mechanism to make livestock agriculture much more of a manufacturing process.
Right. I think that's right.
Is this rolling back? I mean, are people having to, in the absence of being able to just sort of casually provide antibiotics, is that going to force our meat producing industries to be less factory-based in some fashion, or no?
Well, you know, it depends on what you mean by factory-based. I think you're right that in my view, once we started using antibiotics routinely in livestock, that was the foundation for everything that we think of as big industrial-scale farming now, you know, moving animals through very fast, putting them in very large concentrations, cutting costs as much as possible and sort of pushing the externalities of those costs of pollution, of resistant bacteria, and so forth, out from the central business model of meat production. But some of the companies that now are moving against antibiotic use, that the leader of which is Purdue, the Purdue Farms, the big chicken producer, fourth largest in the country, they're showing that they can take antibiotics out of the system and not fundamentally change their system. So if what we still want is very rapidly produced, very industrial scale, very inexpensive protein, we can have it without antibiotics. I think what's promising, though, is that there are small and medium-sized producers, like the folks with the grass-fed farm that we were just talking about in South Georgia, who might never have been able to compete in the marketplace just on the basis of cost, because small and medium-sized production is more labor-intensive.
Right.
But they can compete on being antibiotic-free. It gives them something else to compete on when they couldn't compete just on price. And so this move, even though it's a move by the big companies, it's really fascinating to me that it might open up the market again for small and medium-sized companies too.
I was going to ask, what are the implications for in terms of the monopolies that we have increasingly in agriculture? And I guess maybe you've answered that question, that this just opens up it sounds a little bit boutique-y to me in that regard.
Well, companies some are small. Some are small, you know, beautiful, rolling, green hill, grass-fed farms. But there are also medium-sized companies that are producing mostly chicken, some other poultry, and increasingly some other forms of protein as well, in ways that look like the bigger companies. They have lots of birds at a time. They're in solid-walled barns. You know, they don't have big green rolling hills, but they before did not have the scale to compete with the very large companies. And I think if you bring going antibiotic free and increasing animal welfare back in as a thing you can, as a value you can sell on,
right,
then it changes the shape of it, changes the points of entry into the market. That's important because, I mean, let's be realistic about this. Really large scale protein production, growing at scale, chickens and hogs and cattle, that's never going to go away. It's especially not going to go away now that the economies of the third world are developing, are growing, and their citizens are wanting to eat more meat. I mean, that's a very reliable signal of an economy growing. So India and China and places like that are going to turn to the very intensive meat agriculture that we developed in the United States.
Mm.
And our best hope for keeping that from creating an even worse international epidemic of antibiotic resistance is to be able to show that you can do that kind of intensive meat production, but not have to make antibiotics part of the mix.
And we should just note that there's a whole host of other reasons why we would want to minimize meat production, particularly in terms of you know, anywhere from a sense of humanity and to what it does to the environment. But this is in this sort of, I guess, narrow policy sphere, which is not so narrow. We need antibiotics to be effective.
But you're absolutely right that there are so many other implications to this, from changing animal welfare to reducing air pollution, water pollution, to changing labor relations around you know, very large meat corporations, to changing land use policies. But routine antibiotic use to this point has underpinned all of that. And maybe if we dismantle that, maybe then those other things get to be reconsidered as well.
I'm curious, just lastly, has there been pushback from the companies that make these antibiotics? I mean, I would imagine these are huge, huge businesses.
So this is a really interesting question to me, because when the Obama administration put in these rules, the way that they made them work was not to tell farmers what they couldn't use. They actually asked the pharma companies to change their labels in such a way that antibiotics could no longer be used off-label. They couldn't be used as growth promoters. So two things are going on there. First, there's still a lot of preventive use of antibiotics, that sort of middle category of use of protecting animals against the conditions of being held in close confinement. That's still fully legal all over the world, even though the World Health Organization just last week came out and recommended that it be stopped. So that's a big market. But also, until the developing economies, India and China and so forth, until they turn away from antibiotic use, that's a massive market. So maybe the drug companies are willing to give up on the West because they see so much promise in the market of the developing world. I think we have to wait and see.
That sounds a lot like tobacco.
Doesn't it, Jeff?
Maren McKenna, thank you so much for your time today. The book is Big Chicken, The Incredible Story of How Antibiotics Created Modern Agriculture and Changed the Way the World Eats. We will put a link to that at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.